And our first caller is Greg in San Francisco. Good morning, Greg.
Thanks, Philip. I'm surprised neither of you have mentioned the conspiracy to murder internationally protected persons, Title 18, Section 1116. When I sued the CIA back in the 80s over the assassination program, I discovered this passed in 72 by Congress before the Ford thing. So it's silly for us to talk about executive order when the executive is supposed to execute the law, which says that any murder of a civilian anywhere on the planet, all of those 52 faces on those cards, those were members of a government that, you know, just like if they killed our civilian people in retaliation, that's why Congress didn't want that payback when they were, you know, paying the bills for the murder of Fry before Allende in 73. So the 1972 law, I think it is, Title 18, Section 1116, 1117, conspiracy to murder internationally protected persons, you've got no traction unless you're going to talk about that.
Okay.
And also, more importantly, those air defense stand-downs, the two drone strikes, and the triple demolitions at World Trade Center and the Pentagon, how come nobody has talked about the third demolition at the WTC that you're blaming on these guys in Afghanistan? That you're really insulting our intelligence.
Okay, Greg, thank you very much.
And I turned in time to see what looked like a skyscraper implosion. Looked like it had been done by a demolition crew. The whole thing just collapsing down on itself.
For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before, when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
It was almost as if it were a planned implosion. It just pancaked.
So what's the problem if this was a planned demolition? Well, we are told by government agencies that this building came down as a result of normal office fires. The National Institute of Standards and Technology produced their final report in 2008.
World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires fueled by office furnishings. It did not collapse from explosives or from fuel oil fires.
But what do you think brought down the building?
And what caught my eye is more than 1,300 architects and engineers examined the evidence about Building 7's collapse and disagree with the official report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I certainly am much more open-minded about it than I was, and it is because of the involvement of the 9/11 families and all these engineers and architects.
You are about to hear from architect of 23 years, Richard Gage, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Now there are more than 1,500 architects and engineers who say that it could not have been brought down by office fires. They are backed by 9/11 family members. We're calling for an independent, unbiased investigation.
And if you want to remember, it's 49ers 51 50. They have 4951666 in the 5 moon dime, and our ship is going down unless you show up with hundreds of bucks to the meeting to pay our rent, which is way months past due. Final notice is in the box, but not down yet. Still on 104.1 FM.
There I was completely wasting, out of work and down. All inside, it's so frustrating.
Well, what does that mean when you're part of a criminal conspiracy that forfeited its right to exist when it was... Well, hold on, Webster, where are you playing from? I guess... I don't know, but... Something...
Oh! My CD.
But, okay, now I lost my train of thought.
No problem.
Because I had something queued up somewhere. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Oh, take the place and I'll choose the time. And I'll climb the hill in my own way. Just wait a while for the right day. And as I rise above the tree line and the clouds, I look down.
One of the night.
This week marked the 20th anniversary of the 1995 Kibeho massacre in southwestern Rwanda, where an estimated 8,000 Rwandan Hutu people were killed by Rwandan President Paul Kagame's Rwandan Patriotic Army. The same number of people were killed in Bosnia, also in 1995. The only English language press to report the anniversary were Australian print and radio outlets, and Pacifica's Flashpoints Radio, and the San Francisco Bayview newspaper. KPFA's Ann Garrison spoke to Professor Ed Herman, the co-author of Manufacturing Consent, The Politics of Genocide and Enduring Lies, The Rwandan Genocide in the Propaganda System 20 Years Later, about the massacres and the Western press.
Professor Herman, could you explain why the Kibeho massacre has no place, except by its absence, in what you first identified as the propaganda system in Manufacturing Consent?
Because it was carried out by a client of the United States, and so therefore the people he kills are what in Manufacturing Consent we call unworthy victims. So unworthy victims, and the media follows a party line, and so if they're unworthy victims, the media pays no attention to them. It's a beautiful system.
I should add that the Australian press reported the anniversary of the Kibeho massacre because Australian combat medics and peacekeepers witnessed it, and several of their veterans were quietly decorated for heroic efforts to rescue and treat wounded victims. Many left the military with post-traumatic stress syndrome consequent to witnessing the massacre. But even as they reported this, the Australian press shied away from challenging the official account of the Rwandan massacres that included Kibeho.
Australia is a client of the United States, and its government follows the party line established by the United States, and its media do the same. So it works out very nicely.
And now, by contrast, could you explain the role that Srebrenica, the massacre of 8,000 people in Bosnia, also committed in 1995, plays in the propaganda system?
Well, that was a massacre that was carried out by a target of the United States, and therefore the victims were what we, in Manufacturing Consent, we call worthy victims, and therefore the government pays a lot of attention to them, and the mass media do the same. In fact, in that case, the numbers are usually inflated, and I don't believe there were 8,000 actually murdered. There were thousands killed, but many of them were combat troops, and they were sort of merged with the people who were, in fact, executed. So there's an inflation process, too. But it all works out beautifully that the Serbs were demonized, and therefore their victims were worthy victims in a good propaganda system such as we have. The press pays a lot of attention to it.
Professor Herman, would you like to say something about the essay you're working on now about Golden Silence?
Well, yes, I'm writing on Golden Silence, is that the media is silent on things like where unworthy victims are being killed. So this is a beautiful case study. I mean, it's not reported at all in U.S. press, although you had thousands and thousands of people killed, almost surely more killed than in Srebrenica, and yet the media ignores it completely. So it's a golden silence.
And that was Professor Ed Herman, co-author of Manufacturing Consent, The Politics of Genocide, and Enduring Lies, The Rwandan Genocide in the Propaganda System, 20 Years Later. The audio archive and transcript of the Flashpoints report on the Kibeho Massacre can be found on the website of the San Francisco Bayview, sfbayview.com. For Pacifica, KPFA and Apple Music Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
And I'm DJ Miles, and this is Berkeley Liberation Radio.net and 104.1 FM. And now that the truth is out, let's see the Poppy Bush gang rot in jail for the genocidal 1990 invasion to restore minority rule in Rwanda and carry out the plunder next door in the Congo for your cell phones, Coltan. That's it. Then staging the false flag pretext for oil wars and at the same time arming our ostensible enemy, the Takfiri death squads of the redirection, that was in 2007's terminology, and of course redirection from the bogus war on terror, which is the redirection from the Contra war, which gets a little confusing, and the Arab sting against socialist Iraq, Libya, and Syria with Bill, Hillary, Obama, and their assassin-funding Swiss bank account holder, Eric, and Lanny Brewer and Loretta Lynch. Getaway driver in the Kagame murders that Ann Garrison just talked about, and because it's the 20th anniversary of that big old one, same size as Srebrenica that we got
Let me see. I was not blocking the NATO reinforcements for the peace, UN peacekeepers, but Abe, a Jew who was a conscientious objector in World War II and will never see a bomb he likes, was blocking, and the driver said he wasn't going to stop for us, so I told Abe, okay, I'll take this one. And then Abe went to the federal magistrate with me and explained the little child floating on the tars of Dresden like a human torch as to why a Jew would not want to kill the Germans. So, never mind, or was I?
Let the fight go on. Meet your masters, then knock them on their ass.
When I think of heaven, slipping me in a black wing bird, I think of flying down in your sea of pins and feathers and all of the instruments of belly of a black winged bird. So try to feed me, 'cause I've been here before and I deserve a little more. I'm alone in the service of the queen. I'm alone anywhere but in between. She's been crying, I've been thinking. And I am the rain. Well, I said, mama, 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 why am I so alone? Well, I can't go outside, I'm scared I might not make it home. Well, I'm alive, I'm alive, but I'm sinking in. If there's anyone at home, it's your place, darling. Why don't you invite me?
of the state. Washington officials were warning Malcolm publicly to back off. The unmentioned agency responsible for dealing with such a touchy problem was the CIA. After consulting with LBJ and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, State Department told CIA's Director of Covert Action in a memorandum that, quote, Malcolm has, for all practical purposes, renounced his U.S. citizenship, unquote. Malcolm had never renounced his citizenship, but the State Department was now telling the CIA's Director of Covert Action to deal with him as if he were a foreign adversary. After 18 weeks spent meeting with African leaders, Malcolm X flew back to New York at the end of November 1964. He was soon confronted by an issue of the Nation of Islam newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, featuring an attack on him by Minister Louis X, known later as Louis Farrakhan. Louis X wrote, "The die is set and Malcolm shall not escape, especially after such evil, foolish talk about his benefactor. Such a man as Malcolm is worthy of death," unquote. Louis Farrakhan has in recent years acknowledged publicly that his words were like fuel on a fire and helped create the atmosphere that moved others to kill Malcolm. On December 1st, 64, Malcolm's close friend, Alex Kazon Saki of Ghana, was elected president of the UN General Assembly. Q-U-A-I-S-O-N-S-A-C-K-E-Y. Kazon Saki arranged for Malcolm to have his own office at the UN to organize his human rights campaign. Malcolm was not about to back off from his UN confrontation with the United States on human rights. In February 1965, Malcolm X's office once again almost connected with Martin Luther King. The place was Selma, Alabama, during a turbulent civil rights campaign. The date was February 4th, only 17 days before Malcolm's death. When Malcolm arrived in Selma after speaking at nearby Tuskegee Institute the night before King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference, staff was panicked. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, activists present wanted Malcolm X to speak to the crowd at Brown Chapel. With Dr. King in jail, his SCLC staff called on Coretta Scott King to speak after Malcolm to put out his fire. Mrs. King was instead inspired by Malcolm to see the hope of a transforming convergence between him and her husband. Malcolm told the crowd of activists that because civil rights were human rights, the U.S. government, by failing to uphold their rights, was in violation of the UN Charter. Coretta was then impressed by the gentle way in which Malcolm said to her afterwards, "Mrs. King, will you tell Dr. King that I had planned to visit him in jail? I won't get a chance now because I've got to martyrdom page 6. I've got to leave to get to New York in time to catch a plane for London." Malcolm barred from France. Nonviolence or non-existence. J. Edgar Hoover smears King. Malcolm's home. Firebombed. Okay. At 2:45 a.m. on March 14, 1965, the Queen's home in which Malcolm X and his family were sleeping was firebombed. Malcolm, Betty Shabazz, who was 6 months pregnant with twins, and their four daughters barely escaped. 2 days after the firebombing, police detectives told the media that a whiskey bottle containing gasoline had been found intact and upright on top of a baby dresser in the house, implying that Malcolm had left it there. Both the police and a Nation of Islam spokesman suggested Malcolm burn down his house for the sake of publicity. The police did not mention that it was Betty Shabazz who, on returning to the gutted house to salvage belongings, had found the bottle on her baby's dresser. She had pointed it out to firefighters. How had it gotten there? Malcolm X had been saying, "My house was bombed by the black Muslim movement upon the orders of Elijah Muhammad." When Shabazz discovered the bottle of gasoline on the dresser and the police raised it publicly, she and Malcolm knew, as Shabazz said later, "Only someone in the uniform of a fireman or a policeman could have planted the bottle of gasoline on my baby's dresser." The police had tried to scapegoat them. Malcolm and Betty suspected they were being set up for something worse. In the meantime, a dry run of Malcolm's assassination had already been carried out in the Audubon Ballroom
It was witnessed by New York police infiltrator Gene Roberts, who had become Malcolm's security guard. By this time, Roberts had also become Malcolm's friend and admirer. He was taking his role as Malcolm's bodyguard more seriously than his mentors wanted. When Malcolm X spoke at the Audubon Ballroom on Monday, February 15th, Roberts saw a preview of what would happen the following Sunday, a fake disruption in the audience designed to draw everyone's attention, then a movement elsewhere towards Malcolm, which on Sunday would include three shooters firing simultaneously. Roberts said he called his New York police supervisor. When the meeting was over, he said, "Listen, I just saw the driver on Malcolm's life. I feel it's going to go down next Sunday." He said, "Okay, we'll pass it on."
Black.
And who denies it's what the fight is.